Okay, we are going to call this tax, property tax committee to order. We do have quorum. First on the agenda is the minutes from March 1st. Vice Chair Lee, would you like to make that motion to approve the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move to approve the minutes from March 1st.
March 1st minutes have been moved. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, first up on the agenda, we are going to move one bill around, but we're going to get to the first one, and that is House File. Is that 236? And I will move that House File 236 be laid over for possible inclusion into the tax property tax division. All right. Representative Freiberg, welcome to the committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I've been in the legislature for 10 years. I think this is my first time before the property tax division, so I'm glad to be here. This bill was requested by a couple constituents of mine who are disabled veterans. The disabled veteran homestead exclusion allows veterans with a disability rating of 70% or higher to deduct some of the value of their home from property taxes. This exclusion was created in recognition of the service and sacrifice our disabled veterans provided. Further, many of the more seriously disabled vets have had to make substantial improvements to their homes for access, such as wider doors, access to toilets and sinks, cabinets and cupboards, chairlifts and bed lifts. For a surviving spouse in a house that has had all of these changes, it becomes more difficult to sell the home and move into a smaller home without having to go through major expenses to the home the vet was living in. Unfortunately, we've had the same exclusion amounts since the provision was first established in 2008. Under current law, for veterans with a disability rating of at least 70%, the exclusion amount is $150,000. This means that prior to calculating taxes on the home, $150,000 is subtracted from the home's value. For veterans with a disability rating of 100%, that is total and permanent disability, the exclusion amount is $300,000. The amount of the exclusion should not remain stagnant for 15 years. This bill would raise the disability exclusion from $300,000 to $400,000 and make it proportional to the veteran's disability rating. It would adjust the $400,000 figure for inflation annually, and it would allow a surviving spouse to reapply for the exclusion. Increasing the amount to reflect increased costs in society is a common sense change that furthers the goal of assisting disabled veterans, and I hope members will look favorably upon this legislation. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you. And I don't see anyone signed up to testify. Is there anyone from the audience that would like to speak in favor? Not opposed, of course. Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, I fully support the bill. Good bill. Just, again, the concern expressed about putting things on autopilot. Thought I should mention that. But again, we support our veterans and thank you for the bill.
Anyone else? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to build on that comment, the intent of autopilot, I understand, but with the plethora of bills that come every year, tweaking, shifting, and etc., I think it behooves us to look back and address and continually try to make it, you know, better, more understandable, more simplified. And if we have the crutch of, well, everything's on autopilot, it may take away from the urgency to continually review, and we find ourselves years and years down the line and discovering we got problems. Because anything done to any specific one of the dozens and dozens and dozens of classifications for property taxes shifts and moves things around, the burdens and et cetera. And so as a policy, I'd prefer not to have autopilot, so we're forced to more diligently look at, and when changes are made, think about the repercussions and make adjustments. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Coulter.
Yeah, my apologies for jumping after the lead here, but I just a quick question for, I think it would probably be for nonpartisan staff. Do we know offhand, and apologies, it's okay if you don't have the number right in front of you, approximately how much total in market value is currently excluded because of this, the veterans market value exclusion?
Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coulter, I know Mr. Swanson, who is not with us today, could not be here today, would have that information. I don't have that particular nugget of information available here, but we can get it for you.
Thank you. And I think the purpose in raising this, you know, again, obviously support the bill and all of that, but I always get a little bit wary when we're talking about market value exclusions. Because this is taking money off of the tax base and shifting it elsewhere, and that just gets challenging for property taxpayers. So just wanted to elevate that issue, but definitely support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any other? Representative Lee.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. We will endeavor to let you know for sure at the very beginning of bill presentation to let you know that we want to comment on this. I just want to thank Rep. Howard Rep. Freiberg for bringing this bill before the committee. It's a very worthwhile cause, and I understand the comments that my colleague Rep. Coulter and Lee Quam raised. I think I'd want folks to remember the impact of the policies that we make, and also to fully realize that power we have as legislators. I think our veterans are owed a lot because they ultimately, some people give us the ultimate sacrifice. And whether we debate in this biennium or next biennium, I think it will always be true that we always want to support our veterans. And so understanding the shifts, we make value judgments here about what we think is important. And so that's why I support this proposal, and I appreciate you bringing it before the committee.
Thank you. Anyone else? Seeing none, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I really appreciate this discussion, and I hear the issues that are being raised regarding keeping it on autopilot. I certainly agree in principle that we should reevaluate every policy that we have on the books yearly. But the fact remains that this hasn't been increased in 15 years, so I believe an inflationary adjustment does make sense. And I also think the discussion about exclusions generally is worth having. But we have had a policy in place to exclude a certain amount of property tax value to benefit our disabled veterans, and I think as long as that is the position of the state of Minnesota, I think modest increases in that policy to benefit our veterans make sense. So I'm encouraged by the positive comments about this. Also, really appreciate the bipartisan support, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Chair renews his motion that House File 236 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. House File 236 is laid over. Thank you. Oh, sorry, that was another big whack. Yeah, better get me a smaller stick.
I was going to say, Mr. Chair, you might break that gavel if you're not careful.
I know. Okay, so next up we have House File 2054. Chair moves that House File 2054 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. To the bill, Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll start off by thanking you for adjusting the agenda. Troy Heitzman, who's six, has ants in his pants, and he's ready to go. So, this might be a really simple bill, and if members want to look at the change, it's lines 3.8 and 3.9. That adjustment makes a huge difference for homesteaded resorters across Minnesota. Of course, we've seen unprecedented increases in property tax values around the state, and making the adjustment in Tier 1 from $600,000 to $1 million of market value, and then in the Tier 2 category from $1.7 million to $2.5 million, is a huge deal for folks that are just trying to take care of their families and earn a living, really could use the help. So I will turn it over to my testifiers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank Thank you. I don't know who's first. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Mike Schweeters. I am the current president of the Community of Minnesota Resort Association, and also we have Boyd Lodge up in Cross Lake. And as Representative Heisman has mentioned, our property taxes, like pretty much everybody's, have gone up over the years. This only affects those that we call the mom-and-pop resorts. The typical member of ours, 8 to 10 cabins where they live on site and rent cabins out. Most of them are seasonal. And this, quite honestly, outside of any a mortgage or that, is probably their single largest line item each year. And any assistance that you could provide for that would be greatly appreciated. We thank you for your time, and I will be around for questions, too, if you have any.
Thank you so much. Next testifier, please.
My name is Clint Mueller. We have Balsam Beach Resort up in Bemidji, Minnesota. I am one of the Mon-Pa resorts. We have 8 cabins, 30 seasonal campsites. The property tax issue is huge. My notice this year from Hubbard County, we're in Hubbard County, they're proposing a 38% increase in my property taxes. So any help we can get on this is definitely a positive. You know, everybody's cost of living goes up. We have so much, and for us that is uncontrolled. You know, all our fuel's up, electricity's up. I remember when we bought the resort back in 1995, I was paying 4 cents a kilowatt. Now we're paying 15 cents a kilowatt for electricity. That's up. My insurance, I used to get my insurance for let's say probably $600 a year on my resort. Now I'm probably in that $12,000 to $15,000 a year for insurance. That went up. That's going up another, I think, 20% this year. So we have all these increases that keep climbing up, and wherever we can get some help, and definitely property tax is one of our biggest things. My resort's probably in that $1.8 to $2.3 million range as far as value. So it really helped me out quite a bit, and I'd appreciate any help we can get. And I'm speaking one of... What we made these canoes are all being handed out today. I actually made 220 of these. I made. They're made out of recycled dock boards. Is what they're made out of.
Wow! Right. So I'll be getting them in your inboxes when you return.
They'll be in your inboxes. As far as I go on with this, I don't remember. You got me off track now. But anyway,
welcome to our committee.
Yeah. Well, age has a lot to do with it. I'm getting more and more forgetful. So whatever help we can get from the state side, we'd all really appreciate it. Oh, I know where I was going with that. We have a little under 200 members, and when we bought our resort in 1995, there was 2,400 resorts in the state of Minnesota. This year, we're under 700 for resorts in the state of Minnesota. I used to be the membership chair for the CMR, and I was president for 2 years, so I'm past president. I was lucky to be president during the COVID years. But anyway, so that was a headache. But anyway, when I was chair of the membership, I would call my members and talk to them. And so many of the resorts, a lot of people are working off-site to keep their resorts afloat. Because we're asking them, why aren't you coming down to Dan the Hill? Why aren't you coming to the fall conference and stuff like that? And so a lot of the response I got from the people I talked to is that they can't because they're working, and they have to work off-site to keep their resorts afloat. So whatever help you guys can give us would be greatly appreciated and would help extend the life of tourism in Minnesota as far as the tourism industry goes with resorts. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and we do appreciate everything that you guys do. Thank you. So anyone else would like to testify? I don't know if I've seen the other Mr. Carlson. He's not here. Okay. Member discussion. Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, so this would result in a shift, and I think in other bills that we have in our packet, we have some analysis of that. So I just wonder if that's available for this one. Maybe I'm missing it on the revenue estimate. Oh, am I looking at the wrong thing?
Ms. Schill.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Mr. Chair. Yeah. There's a revenue estimate in your packets. If you don't have one, I could pass to you mine.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Oh,
Madam Chair.
Yes, I was just wondering, could you point, I mean, I kind of read through it, but could you point me to where it talks about the amount of the shift on this page, just so I...
Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, if you take a look on the revenue estimate, the second bullet point mentions that approximately 2,000 parcels containing Class C1 property 390 of those have a taxable market value higher than the first tier limit. And then I'm not seeing right now an overall value attached to that in the note, but we can get that information for you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do understand, having heard other bills in regards to tourism, of where hotels, resorts, and said entities are pitching in either a fee or some percent on lodging. It'd be nice when we get the final omnibus that we had sort of a list or a notation. Yes, the property taxes have been adjusted, but there is also in parallel a specified, you know, other fees, they're going locally. But I would like, with all these bills, when we have the final one and know what's included, that we have sort of a table that lists the each one, how much of a decrease or shift from each one of the sections, which would have been each bill. But then in the end, a table of all the areas that did not get any shift. In other words, if you got some shift from you, then you'd be listed here. But on the end, if you're one of the classifications that has no mitigation, no shift, which means you're getting all of these other things shifted to you, some information on that, proportionality, it'll be like, 15 or 10. Yeah. And that way we can understand the ramifications of the entire package.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you guys for what you do. It's tough. Some of the smaller resorts are on my area. Because of rising values, they're having to parcel and sell off pieces because it's just too expensive to keep up with these rising valuations. So, yeah, the need is there. Just a quick question. You mentioned a 38% increase. Was that in your valuation or your actual tax statement?
That is what they sent me out as a proposal. So exactly what it will end up being, I won't know till my new tax statement comes out. But that was in my proposal from this spring or last fall, and they sent it out.
Representative Anderson.
No, not much follow-up, but again, I'm a farmer. I know what's happening to land values, but I can only imagine what's happening to lakeshore values that you're really hit with. So, we want to keep these folks in business and support this.
Totally agree, Representative Anderson. Anyone else? Closing comments, Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are just grateful to have the opportunity to present this bill and are working towards supporting the very time-honored tradition of Minnesota, support our small resorters. Thank you, and it's a fine piece of legislation. I hope everybody can support it.
Thank you for bringing it forward, Representative Heitzman. The chair renews his motion that House File 2504 be laid over for possible...
054.
What?
It's 2054.
2054 be laid over for the Property Tax Division. So moved. Thank you so much. Okay, so which one are we at? Howard now?
Yeah, we can do
it. Okay. Yeah. All right. So which one are we going to? We got Representative Hornstein or Chair Hornstein staring at me. We're definitely going to go to him. I'm getting nervous here. There we are. There.
Mr. Chair, can I vote no?
Just
on
wanted
that
to
one?
Keep you going.
Oh, you got me going, man.
We're not voting, but you can vote no.
Yeah. 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 All right, next up we have House File 2172. The chair moves that House File 2172 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. I believe that there is an amendment. Representative Hornstein, would you like to move your amendment now to get the bill in
yes.
the order?
Yes, if you could move that or
Will
someone
do.
On the committee could move it, that would be great.
Yep. The chair moves that the A1 amendment be included. Any discussion from members? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Hornstein, two-year bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members. I'm very pleased to present House File 2172. And I thank the members of the committee who've co-authored this, including, Mr. Chair, your co-authorship. It's a bill that I think has been before the committee in the past. Representative Dabney carried it. And now downtown is part of the area I represent, downtown Minneapolis, under redistricting. So it's a new area for me, and I'm very pleased to carry this on behalf of the hospitality and tourism industry in my community, which I think in communities across the state have suffered under the impacts of COVID-19. And so although there's been some recovery, we want to make sure that that recovery can continue and this industry can grow and thrive. As we heard in the previous bill, there's a lot of economic activity associated with tourism. Thousands of our constituents are employed or directly and indirectly in this industry. In the area I represent, we have 26 hotels just in my area, and a strong hotel and tourism industry is vital to a strong downtown Minneapolis as an entertainment and employment center. And so this bill authorizes what's known as a tourism improvement district. And the bill itself really goes through the process for setting up this type of district. It's not a new concept in our state and certainly across the country. There are 200 cities in 21 states that have authorized tourism improvement districts. I was particularly impressed with a couple in California. One used the revenue from this for tree planting. Another used it for a circulator through a tourism district that offered free rides for both residents and tourists in that community. So this bill is statewide in nature. And again, we have a number of other states that have a similar legislation. So a tourism improvement district is a public-private partnership. It's not a requirement. This is not a mandate. A city or county would have the ability under this legislation to set up such a district. And so there are a couple handouts in your packets. And again, the bill itself is really establishing the district and going through the public process for that establishment, setting up rules and parameters. And I'm particularly pleased that there's a strong public engagement piece to it. So, Mr. Chair, I have one testifier, if you will, and we can maybe take the testimony and if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Yes, we do. Mr. Tennant, could you please welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Listegard. Melvin Tennant. I am the president and CEO of Meet Minneapolis, which is our convention and visitors association responsible for marketing Minneapolis as a destination for all sorts of travel. So thank you, Chair and members of the committee, for allowing us to share some thoughts this morning. I want to thank you, Representative Hornstein, for authoring this bill and for continuing to move this momentum forward. We're excited here today to ask you for support of House File 2172 to allow for the creation of Tourism Improvement Districts, or TIDs, in Minnesota. You might remember that this was included in the last two House omnibus bills in 21 and 22, so we thank you for that. And this is a mechanism, as the representative said, for a private partnership of additive funding for destination marketing and tourism activities, and it must start with the lodging industry, so that's where it emanates from. To form a tourism improvement district, which is then adopted through the local ordinance process. It is a service charge placed on lodging businesses, probably have paid it California. This is where it really began and where a lot of the work has been done to test this particular concept. And it can only be used for specific tourism marketing purposes, benefiting those that are collecting in a very defined geographic region. So that's really important in this. Again, this is new to our state, but it's been a concept that we've seen across the country for more than a quarter century, so something that I think can really be a nice tool for us. And as Representative Hornstein said, it's in 21 states. It's in 201 cities at this point. And Massachusetts, Virginia, and Utah were the most recent states that have implemented it. And literally within the last 2 weeks, Governor Pritzker of Illinois signed their state's Tourism Improvement District legislation into law. And I think that's really important to note because Illinois, Chicago, is a very close competitor of us in the tourism marketing effort. So, again, they have the tool, and we'd certainly like your support in getting us this tool. We've also seen it in our neighboring state of South Dakota for 20 years in cities both large and small. And, again, just to remind you that this is a service charge that's supplemental to existing funding, meant to not supplant existing funding. It's really important that we continue to augment the ability to increase economic impact. In other states, the TID has proven to be a tool that generates funding for the tourism industry, which, very important to me, also allows us then to get more workers back on the job because there's a direct correlation between tourism promotion, convention and visitors, and people that are needed to service the needs of the visitors. So that's a very important aspect of this. I want to let you know that this legislation has a number of supporters, and you have on your handout all of the other destination marketing organizations that have signed on to this, including St. Paul, Bloomington, Duluth, Iron Range Tourism, Rochester, Shakopee, Grand Rapids, and many others. So, again, a very broad spectrum of destination marketing organizations. So, again, we believe it's going to be a game changer, Chair Liz Lagarde, and it will have no fiscal impact on the state's budget. It's just enabling legislation, and as Representative Hornstein said, will allow a city or county to institute this particular tool. So I just want to thank you for consideration of this bill.
Well, thank you. You won me when you said Iron Range Tourism. So, next we have Bill Deef. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Liskard and committee members. My name is Bill Deef. I work in public affairs for Meet Minneapolis. And I'd like to address how the legislation will work for Minnesota communities. Basically, what are the mechanics and what does it do? If the enabling legislation for tourism improvement districts in Minnesota is passed, this will allow the community, the hotel community, to have a conversation with their local municipality to see if this is a good fit for their community. We have included counties in the language as this is important to areas that operate tourism organizations countywide. So think of Lake County, Cook County, Lake of the Woods. That was important that if they chose to form a TID, that it would be countywide rather than just a municipality. I want to reiterate, this is a service fee on lodging properties only. Doesn't include retailers, restaurants, other service companies or businesses in the community, just lodging. And the hotel ownership in this group would need to vote in favor of forming a TID. They would need 50% or more of the hotels in the designated area to vote in favor to be able to move forward. And the next in the process is that group would formalize the parameters of a TID and develop a service plan, including programs to be funded, a budget, boundaries, the term of the TID, rate, and fund management. And that that proposal then goes to the municipality or the county for approval. In turn, this will benefit the lodging businesses, the local government, and the entire community through increased economic activity. For example, more people staying in hotels means more people eating at restaurants, shopping, visiting museums, attending sporting events, and concerts. And you have probably paid this TID on your hotel bill in other states that you visited, like Montana or Florida or California. The local government will formally create the TID through an ordinance process, and the local CVB would be directed to manage the program of work and spending on behalf of and oversight from this group of hotels that have formed the TID. In essence, the hotels would have a contract with the local CVB to carry out the work. The bill has lots of checks and balances through the local ordinance process by requiring the local government approval and adoption. It requires an annual plan of work and a budget to present it to the city or county and report on the return on investment in tourism. This is just like special service districts throughout Minnesota today. And it require, and finally, the TID operates with a defined term which must be renewed by the participating businesses, and any changes to the TID would require a new petition of the hotels. So thank you again for the chair and the committee for your consideration of this and for this important legislation for the Minnesota hospitality community. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Ms. Loy. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Lissagard and committee. This is definitely a first for me, so lovely to be here. I'm Christy Loy. I am the president of the Greater Minneapolis Hotel Association, as well as the general manager at W Hotel in the Fauché Tower, and representing our industry today, who has really, as an association, voted in support of helping to get this enabling legislation passed. I moved here to Minnesota in 2020. March 2nd was my first day of work. So I say that to tell you that I think this is the best place I've ever lived, and I think that everyone should come visit our city, and we need to be able to get that message out there. So this legislation is another important way to support the industry statewide to be able to do so. I probably don't have to tell you that during the pandemic, our industry suffered greatly and was impacted the most. That's certainly true in Minneapolis as a city. Even last year, our occupancies reached just 47%. Statewide, the average was 55%, and in the United States, 63%. So we really need this legislation in our state to be able to push forward and get back to where I know we can be, which is also having our people back to work. So we lost, out of our 36,000 hotel and restaurant employees, 50% of those lost employment during COVID-19, and I still don't have my full team back to work. So a lot of that for us is associated with consistency and being able to drive new demand in tourism and bring new entities, new conventions and other types of travelers into our state. So this legislation is so important to me because it's really the people in our business that make a difference, and part of what we want to do is bring those people back to work. So I think in Minneapolis specifically, we would use this money for marketing. We would use this money to attract new conventions, to create that demand, and also for workforce development, because this is an amazing industry. It's full of fun and full of being able to tell our story to all the people who come to visit Minnesota. But we had our own workforce challenges prior to COVID-19, and we still want to be developing in this industry. It's one of the industries with the fastest path to leadership, and it's also an amazing entry industry for those that are recently immigrated or who may not have English as a first language. It's really a spectacular place to work. So we would really appreciate your support in approving this House File 2172 and helping us to get this legislation done. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And if that was your first time, that was incredible. anyone else would like to testify? Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, this would be a separate fee or tax on a hotel room. I think there's also a lodging tax. What other fees are assessed on the bill for a hotel room in Minneapolis?
Ms. Loy.
Do you want me to answer that? Or I don't know who's best answer, but I'll answer it. So we really just have taxes right now that are associated, and we're, I think, 70th in the United States in the tax rate. Bill's a lot smarter about this stuff than me. So right now we're really just assessing, so city tax, state tax.
Legacy funding.
Mr. Deef, could you state your name again for the record and
yes.
then answer the question?
Yes, Chair Lissagard, Representative There are a number of taxes that make up the hotel tax for the city of Minneapolis, and they may differ in communities across the state of Minnesota. Ours includes, of course, the state sales tax, the 3% lodging tax. There are additional taxes for entertainment, for Hennepin County, and I believe for the legacy funding that make up the 14.03% if you stay in a Minneapolis lodging property.
Representative Anderson.
Again, thanks, Mr. Chair. Who, you say there's going to be a separate kind of organization to assess this. Have you talked about how much this is going to be or what it's going to be exactly used for, that type of thing?
Mr. D.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. Yes, there's a group of, in our case, in Minneapolis, there's a group that we've formed of 12 hotels that have been looking at this issue for the last couple of years. And they have set what they think are the defined parameters. What they want to see it used for is bringing in more groups. That's conventions, meetings, events, possibly creation of new events, things that are going to drive overnight visitation from outside the area for people to come and stay in the city of Minneapolis. So they're looking at driving more public relations efforts. We all know that we have to create some new buzz about the city of Minneapolis and why people want to come to stay here. So they're interested in that. And then as Christy spoke to about workforce issues, about how can we attract more people into the industry, how can we tell them these are good paying jobs, that it does have a path to others in the industry and develop that pipeline. So those are the things that, at least in the city of Minneapolis, that the hotels are most interested in.
Representative Anderson. Okay, thank you. Next, Vice Chair Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also want to thank Rep. Anderson for teeing up my question. I had a similar question because I know we already have a lodging tax, and so I wanted to know the difference between the proposal that Rep. Hornstein has brought before us and the lodging tax. I'm curious. I know where Rep. Anderson was going. You know, why is there a need now for this kind of tax? Sympathetic, of course, to the industry and what's happened in the last couple of years, but I'm also wondering if maybe the way the lodging tax was written was too narrow, and is this maybe why, you know, you're bringing this proposal before us? I'm just curious if the author or, you know, someone could comment on that.
Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, so this would be completely separate from the lodging tax, and the lodging tax funds go to fund different things in the city, so these funds wouldn't be commingled with that. Can you just restate your question? I'm sorry, I'm trying to switch out.
No, understandable. So there is a lodging tax already. I'm curious if you can tell us what that's typically used for. I mean, we've heard today this proposal would fund maybe workforce training and marketing to increase tourism. Are those things that can currently be done with the lodging tax?
Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, short answer would be no. Typically, a lodging tax would have to be used to promote tourism to the city that imposes it. These are the ones that the cities are able to do on their own under statute, and 95% of those proceeds have to go to funding the tourism. So workforce development and things that the workforce in the hotel would not be covered under the lodging tax.
Vice Chair Lee.
Great. Thank you. I mean, my question is just maybe instead of a new tax, could we just expand what we can do with the lodging tax? And I don't know if that makes sense, but just want to explore that because I think something that we've also talked about is also simplifying our tax code. But I'm also not opposed to this proposal. I'm just kind of trying to think about how we write our code. Thank you.
Okay. Next, we have Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you, Ms. Loy, for your comments on the importance of the hospitality industry to really, I mean, the entire metro region and the state. I will take this opportunity to point out that my city has more hotel rooms than I think Minneapolis and St. Paul combined, if I'm remembering, or at least certainly each of them individually, but we got a lot of hotel rooms in Bloomington. And I also want to
sales pitch.
There you go. And I also want to thank you for your comments as well about the nature of the folks who work in hospitality. I think that's a piece that we frankly don't talk often enough about, and who really makes hotels run and that sort of thing. My question, and I'm not sure if it's for Representative Hornstein or one of the testifiers, but I, you know, the definition of municipality here says county, city, or town. And I would hope this would never be the case, but I could certainly envision a situation where, for example, a city decides they don't want to do this, and then the businesses appeal to the county, who sort of, for lack of a better term, might override the city. Is that, I mean, has that been a consideration? Is there any concern about that? Because as a former city council member, I get a little bit anxious about that idea.
Chair Lissagard, representative, thanks for the question. The language is written so that it could be a city or a county. It can't be both, so there's no double dipping there. But in reference to what you're speaking to, if the city was unable to pass it with the number of hotels they have, it would be unlikely that a county with probably many more properties would be unable to do so too. So I don't think that's the case. And as I spoke before, we have talked to our colleagues in Bloomington. There's no intention of looking at a Hennepin County TID. That we think this is best determined at the municipal level in the Twin Cities area.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would also think that a good county board probably would not override their city councils in that way. But I guess maybe just sort of food for thought there in terms of tightening up the language so that we could potentially address that possibility on the front end. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Lissagard, and thank you, Representative Hornstein, for bringing this bill. I wanted a little bit of clarification. I heard that it was 50% or more of the relevant businesses or lodgings would have to vote in order to have to agree to it in order to move forward. And I guess I was wondering, I was trying to look through the definitions and looking up the other statutes, because what counts as a qualifying business or lodging?
Mr. Deef.
Yes, Chair Lissagard, representative, what qualifies as a lodging business is what is determined in the city today as a taxable lodging business. So in Minneapolis, that would require 50 rooms or more. Places that would be less than 50 rooms would not be paying this service fee. So in our case, we have 45 hotel properties in the city. 23 would have to vote in favor. Our group has already said if we don't have 75 or 80%, not just the 50%, we're going to have a lot of unhappy hoteliers in the city. So they really want to take the time to educate everybody, including the ownership, who's sometimes not on site, on property or here, to understand why this is important. But again, this was brought forward to us in Minneapolis by general managers that had been in other states around the country and had seen this been successful in doing more for their municipalities. So it's 50% or more, this is how it's written, but we're certainly hoping for a larger number than that.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you. That's really helpful. So how does this 50% or more, with the definition being determined by the municipality, interact with it being either a city or a county? Because I'm assuming that that might be different. The definition of a lodging for Bloomington might be different than for Minneapolis. Is that correct?
Mr. Deef.
Chair Lissagard, representative, I believe that is correct, that it could be different what is taxed in each city or in the county. So what happens in Cook County or Lake County could be a different format than what we have in Minneapolis.
Representative Hollins.
Okay, maybe I'm getting too in the weeds here. If Minneapolis says 40 rooms or more counts as one of these lodgings, but Bloomington says it has to be 50 rooms or more, and you want to do a Hennepin County version of this, how is that, like, how does that play out?
Mr. Deef.
Chair Lissagard, representative, I'm not sure how the language is written. I'll have to go back and double check on that. We're not anticipating, the reason it was structured that way is because these are lodging properties that are currently paying the local option lodging tax. So we thought it was best to marry up with those that are already paying this tax to bring the TID service charge to be on those properties only and not others. In other places around the country, it might be different. They might be doing short-term rentals, but we're not looking at short-term rentals. We're looking at just those paying the lodging tax today.
Representative Hollins?
All right. Thank you. Yeah, this was very helpful. I appreciate it. And just to be clear, I am in favor of this. I think I'm a co-author on the bill. So I just had clarifying questions. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Chair Gomez.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Hornstein. And we've actually like been meaning to have a meeting on this and haven't, so I'm sorry if I'm like should have asked these questions before, but so my understanding is this is sort of based on a special service district model, and I'm trying to think back to my time at the city, and as I recall, those talks about imposing service charges here, and so as I recall, in a special service district, it's sort of like a business's like sort of proportional share of the benefit then gets like added onto their property taxes. And so I'm just wondering if you can talk me through, like, the mechanism, because actually, so there's, like Bloomington has a 7% lodging tax. In Minneapolis, it's 3% if you're less than 50 rooms, but it's 5.125% more than 50. St. Paul has 7 for more than 50 rooms, 3% for other. And so those, as a consumer, of course, those are, like, right there on your receipt, so you can kind of see it. But if imposing a service charge in this case is aligned with that special service district approach, then this would just be like added onto the property taxes, and so it's not like a kind of something that the consumer sees. So I just, can you walk me through that, how those charges would be imposed?
Thank Mr. Deeve.
Chair Lissigard, Representative Gomez, thank you for the question. When we explored this, what we discovered early on by working with the city attorney in Minneapolis is the reason we're here is that special service districts, which are common across Minnesota and have been set up for years, are based on property taxes. And this is not based on a property tax. It's a service charge at checkout. And because of that, it requires enabling legislation from the state for communities to be able to do this. So we're not able to do this today. You can't just add an extra charge onto a hotel room. We need legislation to be able to do that. So it's not related to property tax. It is listed clearly on checkout. You've probably seen this if you've paid it in another hotel. It would say Tourism Improvement District or Tourism Marketing Charge or something of that is listed clearly at checkout. And it's listed clearly in advance if you're on a third-party website or the hotel's website. It is listed as a charge that you would be responsible for paying at checkout.
Chair Gomez, you're good?
I'm good.
All right.
Thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm glad I let her go before me because I was looking at the page from the Department of Revenue, and I'm used to seeing lots of zeros, but not only zeros. So this would not be a business expense because it's directly charged to the customer. That clarification.
Mr. Cope?
The charge would be on the business owners themselves, not to consumers.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That seemed to be conflicting to a service charge showing up on a receipt to a customer like a fee. So it might be good, since it's being laid over, to get clarification to the committee on exactly how that rolls out, because I was just surprised because I was interpreting what staff just mentioned and that it'd be a business expense because the business would be paying it, so that the all zeros on the DOR page would have a little inaccuracy in the fact that you could deduct a business expense like that. But I do have one question for the author, and that would be, could this help develop, implement, or support microtransit? Because that could be tied into tourism quite well.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Quam. Yes, in fact, one of the examples I cited earlier in California, they did use funds from this to use a carbon-free, I don't know if it was an electric vehicle or some another type of propulsion, but they used a vehicle to offer rides within the district, actually free of charge, to both tourists and residents. And I can check on the city. I don't remember offhand which one it was.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just appreciate that the author is trying to include forward and more modern thinking of ways of doing things. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Seeing none, closing comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and there are some really great questions. I appreciated, Representative Lee, your question, and we'll certainly look at that, and Representative Holland, your question. So, the bill's being laid over, and I welcome any additional input from the committee as we move forward. And again, Mr. Chair, thank you so much for hearing the bill.
Thank you. Okay, Chair renews his motion that House File 2172, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. House File 2172, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Okay, next, we have House File 1103. Representative Stevenson. Chair moves that House File 1103 be laid over for possible inclusion into the Property Tax Division report. There is an amendment. Representative Stevens, would you like me to, Stevenson, would you like me to move?
Yeah. Well? Yes, Mr. Chair. It's an author's amendment, and then I can describe maybe the totality of the proposal once the amendment's adopted.
Okay. Chair moves that A2 amendment be included. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. To the bill, Representative Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I think all members are aware that we are having a mental health crisis in our state and in our country, and but with particular regard to our first responders. I think a lot of members are aware of the problems that PTSD and other mental health conditions are causing in law enforcement, but in all of our first responder fields. House File 1103 takes a program that has been working very successfully in a number of communities, including Plymouth and Blaine and Coon Rapids, and tries to take it to a statewide level and also expand it beyond the current practice, which is more limited to police, to all first responders. The program's generally colloquially referred to as NECUP CHECUP, and the idea is that first responders have the opportunity to visit with a mental health professional under this bill twice a year. Some cities are doing it once a year for an hour, and there's no requirement to talk about anything in particular, anything at all. Just have to go and have a conversation with the mental health professional. The idea is to catch early problems that could become much bigger. And I will say that in talking with my own police chief in Coon Rapids, what he told me was that he heard a lot of, when the program was implemented in Coon Rapids, he heard a lot of grumbling from officers. Do I really have to go do this? Do I really want to go do this? But the reviews afterwards were uniformly positive. And in Coon Rapids, they offer additional follow-up mental health services to people totally at request, totally voluntary. And the uptake on those requests has been really high. People have been taking advantages of the service, so, which means that this works. It catches problems that then people get help with later on. The amendment that you were just kind enough to adopt just includes a really small but important provision, which says that the information that is shared by the first responder during that visit with the mental health professional can't be used for disciplinary or employment reasons. We want to make sure that people feel at liberty to share what they need to share to get the help that they need. So that's the sum of this. I'm happy to answer questions, but before that, Mr. Chair, I do have a constituent who I think would really like to talk to the committee about his experience.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and please proceed with your testimony.
My name is John Ratajczyk, and thank you for your time. I apologize for my lack of formality. This is my first time. I've been a police officer in the state of Minnesota for 32 years, recently retired with PTSD disability. 27 of those years was with the city of Brooklyn Center, and the last 16 I was a detective investigating various crimes against people, property, etc. The last few years I specialized in homicide, child physical and sexual abuse, child pornography, and online enticement of minors on the internet. In 2002, I was a parole officer, and we had in-service training, and a doctor had come into our in-service training and talked about the importance of us managing our stress levels. With the caveat that we have to be careful what we say and who we say it to, because it could affect our post license. For me, that message was, okay, you got to take care of yourself, but don't tell anybody you're struggling, because you could be out of your job, you will no longer have a means to take care of your family, pay your bills, etc. Fast forward to July 2014, that was the day that I realized that my cup had overfilled. As a detective, we don't respond to 911 calls. We respond after the patrol officers go, make the scene safe, take care of the people that need taken care of. On this particular day, there was nobody available, so I had to go. Apologize for this. I went to a call of a young girl, 14-month-old Hmong girl, who had been run over by her father. This is particularly important to me because my daughter is half Korean and about the same age at the same time. And when I responded to that scene, what I found was a toddler who had been run over not once but twice. Tire marks across her chest, across her face. And in hindsight, it was clear to me that I could not do anything to save her life or bring her back to life. Yet, the cop in me still tried. After that incident, I began therapy. And therapy was working for a while. And after a while, imagery, dreams, nightmares started coming back. April of 2021, we had an officer-involved shooting in Brooklyn Center. And my then 9-year-old daughter said to me one morning, taking her to school, "Daddy, why are people attacking your work?" And I explained to her that how the best I could explain to a 9-year-old that one of my partners had shot somebody that she didn't intend to shoot, and people were really upset about that and what she did was wrong, and they wanted to be heard. And she responded to me on that drive to school, "Don't worry, Daddy, if they hurt you or kill you, I will come to your gravesite every day." Thirteen days later was my last day at work, because I could no longer do my job, take care of my family, take care of myself without just being a mess of everything. I had to quit my career because of the years and years and years of memories that I had been putting away time and time again. And my experience isn't unique to police officers. Granted, an officer in Baudette, Minnesota probably doesn't respond to the number of critical incidents that I did. But I know that there are some in Minneapolis that spent time at many, many more. And it's important to understand that each one of these incidents affects us all very differently. the neck-up checkups, had they been in place earlier in my career, I believe I'd still be at work. I would be sharing my skill set with new employees that are coming up. I would still be handling my cases and representing my victims when I testify for them in court as to what happened and why it happened and who did it. But I can't do that anymore. Neck-up checkups. That started in a couple different agencies around us, and the months prior to my early departure, I began working on it with our city manager, our chief of police, and it was about to happen, and then the Officer Potter shooting of Dante Wright happened, and everything exploded. The world, you know, the world for us there. To change us all forever. So I want to thank you for hearing me. I know I went a little over. I'm open to having some questions if anybody wants to talk about anything like this. But it's important to me that I leave Brooklyn Center and policing better than I received it. And a lot of us can stay at work if we have these early interventions and have somebody to talk to without knowing or without the fear of it being used against us. And yeah, so thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for sharing your story.
Thanks.
There's nothing to be ashamed about. I mean, this is exactly where you need to be. Tell your story to improve other people's lives. So thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else that wants to testify for this bill? Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. Instead of building this in the localities, I've been on the EMSRB and involved in a lot of school board things of where both those entities have tragic events. And I've always been a proponent for regional or statewide resources to come in and cover these things. Because two things. One, you want the privacy and being able to talk to where it doesn't get to anyone that's in the local district, so you feel free to speak. But number two, even if you weren't directly involved in something that happens in the community, that with this amount of emotional and traumatic event, the people that are helping can also be somewhat impacted or impaired or affected, and by having a regional or statewide group of people are specially trained and come in, you gain two things. Well, you gain three. One, there's a little bit more anonymity. Two, they aren't directly related, involved. It's not their neighbor or, you know, those type of events. And so it's easier to not be affected, but three, they would be more, throughout a year, they would come across this more often. And I think that might make it easier for them to build and be fresh on how to interact. I'm not saying anything about the intent. I'm just trying to add some context to where it could be better, because my wife was on the first responders for over a decade, the head of it, and when you hit that one that's the tripping point, and it really gets you, that's not the only one that floods on you. Because you've got other ones, and it's not your fault that you didn't know there was a toddler in a vehicle
until you some you see, oh, it's that night and you see a car seat in the ditch 40 feet away. And the impact that compounds isn't, it could very well be on the people that are trying to be in the system to help that you're developing. So that's why I'm suggesting the options of regional or state support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Coulter.
Yep, and I know we are short on time here, so I'll be very quick. Representative Stevenson, just curious about the definition of firefighter and why that's limited to full-time. And the reason I ask that, for example, is that Bloomington still has a paid on-call fire department. We are working on transitioning away from that, but it's still going to be a few years before we're up to a completely full-time department.
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coulter, let me start by saying happy to work with you on how to do a definition. I remember when we drafted this, we chose this definition for mostly administrative purposes to have a defined set of people that would make it easier to administer the funding here. But obviously, you know, I value firefighters of all persuasions, and we could look at other ways to do it too. So we can keep talking.
Representative Coulter. Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Real quickly, and I'm thank you. I'm a fellow first responder for 30 years, and your story hit with me. What I think Representative Quam is relating to, and you will know the word as soon as I say it, is CISD training. We've had that for 20 years, and I wasn't really reluctant that that was working because of the obviously it's not, right?
It has its place.
Right.
For my 2014 event, I didn't go back to work for 6 weeks, let alone attend
CISD. Sit in a group, right? And so right. I think that I'm optimistic about this. I've heard about it. I think it's a really good start for us. I think we got to look at what we've done, and I'm with stories like yours, I think we can move forward with this and try to put some resources into doing this. I mean, and I don't think it's too late for you. I think that you'll be able to help us with stuff like this, and your story tells a lot, right?
It does. I see this as my recovery is, it's going to take time.
Right.
I took 32 years to accumulate a bunch of garbage that's in my head that I just kept putting away and putting away, putting away. And it takes time.
What I'm trying to get across, you don't want to end up as a legislator like I did with my garbage, right? So, I mean, I think you're on the right track, and I think Representative Stevenson, there are some parts in the bill that I think Representative Coulter, but, and we've worked together on this before, Representative Stevenson. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I came to the game late, so.
Nope, that's okay. Thank you. Representative Anderson, real quick, and then we have to go to closing comments.
Yeah, very quickly, thanks for the bill. Thank you for your service, sir. Representative Stevenson, kind of a mandate here. Is the funding going to be enough that our local cities and counties will not have to carry some of the costs themselves, or is your funding adequate?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that is the intent of the bill, for it to fully cover the cost.
Representative Anderson. Okay. Thank you. Closing comments, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I know you're busy, so I'll just say that I think, you know, this bill asks for $9 million, and I think given what's at stake, that is a very, very modest amount of money. So I'd ask the chair, the committee to consider it.
Well, thank you both for coming before us today. The chair renews his motion that House File 1103, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. House File 1103, as amended, is laid over.
And Mr. Chair, may we have donuts for the road?
Yes, you can. Would you, yes. Would you please read what the sign says?
Read it to the
committee.
Please.
To the committee
record. Sunrise Donuts of Bloomington from the DFL freshmen who know their place.
Hey. All right. Thank you. All right. So, and we have to go back up. And okay. Where it is. There it is. House File 1808. Chair moves that House File 1808 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. There is an amendment. Would you like me to move that amendment, Representative Howard?
Yes, please, Chair Lestigarde.
Chair moves that, what is it, the A1 amendment be included. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. It is included. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Lestigarde, and thank you for hearing this bill today. It's an important one. It's a bill that I've carried for 5 years in the legislature, and it's one that I hope we get across the finish line this session. It's been bipartisan in the past. It was carried in the omnibus tax. It was in the final omnibus conference committee that did not pass last session. And so we got one little hurdle to go over this year. And it deals with an issue that's important to communities all across the state, and that's our affordable housing crisis. And I always give you a little background on this bill, what it seeks to solve. And for taxation purposes, affordable housing is assessed at the same value as market rate, even though it cannot generate the same value unless rents are not affordable. To correct this, in years past, the legislature created a property tax status called 4D to create a lower rate to incent the creation and preservation of affordable housing that we so desperately need all across Minnesota. Like most of us, I had no idea what 4D property tax rate was until I saw the real and tangible impact in my own community. When I was a city council member in Richfield, Seasons Park, it was a 400-unit naturally occurring affordable housing property, meaning that there was no public subsidy to it, but it was affordable. A for-profit entity was about to purchase it and in the process evict all of those 400 families, including 300 children. It was one of our only units that had many 2- and 3-bedroom units. It was on the brink of a sale. We worked quickly and found Aon, a nonprofit developer who kind of swooped in at the last minute, was able to pull together the financing to purchase and begin the work and rehab of that property. And that would not have been possible without the 4D property, the 4D property tax status that was critical. The challenge is that since this 4D rate has been place, its value has been greatly minimized because, as you all know, the values of properties have escalated significantly. And as I mentioned, they're assessed at the same rate. So the benefit has essentially evaporated. For most of these entities, their property taxes have essentially doubled. For low-income class 4D properties, wiping out this benefit. And so what this bill would do was help bring this 4D rate in line with its original purpose, to ensure that we're providing this important resource in our community, affordable housing, with a property tax rate that allows us to build more and preserve more affordable housing. Members, this is an issue of racial equity. We have some of the largest racial equity gaps in the country in terms of renters, and this bill will help us make sure that our renters are able to maintain stably housed and affordable housing. And it's a critical tool and issue relevant all across the state. Lastly, I want to respond to one potential criticism of the bill, which is that it will cause property tax shifts. This is the fifth year, again, that I've worked on this bill, and it's received a lot of study. A property tax analysis that you all have shows a very, very modest shift. Just 43 cities across the whole state will see a more than 2% overall tax capacity shift. And of those 43, 29 would see less than a $20 shift on the average home. But this is important. We know that property taxes on homeowners are a significant pressure point as well, which is why we've included transition aid in this bill. They would provide specific aid to the communities that see those larger property tax shifts. Members, our affordable housing providers are really, really in a challenging spot post-pandemic. These are the entities that are in our community providing and creating and preserving the housing that we need, and this bill is critical to make sure that they have what they need to continue providing affordable housing in our communities, and I would encourage your support.
Well, thank you, and I know how hard you've been working on this over the years. So, testifiers, Mr. Williams is up first. If you could come. I don't mean to be rude, but we are very, very short on time, so if we could shorten it, you know, a little bit.
We'll move
not
quickly.
To demean the importance of this issue, but the clock. So.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Paul Williams, President and CEO of Project for Pride and Living, a nonprofit developer in the Twin Cities urban areas, suburban areas as well. We own and manage more than 1,600 affordable housings. Every day, 3,500 folks live with us. Vast majority of those folks are folks of color. Over 70% are black, and well, about half of our units are designed particularly for very low income. The truth is about 80%+ of our residents are below 30% of median income. And so this is a critical issue. It's an operating issue for us. As Representative Howard said, access to safe, affordable housing is a racial equity issue. It's an education issue. It's a workforce issue. It's an economic competitiveness issue. We're one of 20 members of the 4D coalition, a private nonprofit coalition of folks working on this issue. We collectively own and manage affordable housing that touches over 90% of the state's low-income rental properties. The key issue here is this change, this shift, really allows us to address the service funding issues, the repair issues. Anybody who is in the affordable housing business right now, coming out of the pandemic especially, I mean, you've heard today about the impacts on not only the rising properties, but the increasing costs, insurance, utilities, security, service costs, all kind of through the roof. And so for us, at PPL alone, across that 1,600 units, it translates into about $1 million a year. I run a $200,000 to $300,000 deficit in my ability every year to provide services for the folks who live in our housing. This $1 million helps capture that. I know already that this year I will lose $1.2 million just by owning the housing that we have right now. So that's just one organization. Again, my other nonprofit partners are kind of going through the same thing. Many for-profit partners are going through the same thing. So as Representative Howard said, the impact of the change is critical to kind of future production as well. If you can't make it pencil out, folks aren't going to step up and do it. And at a time when we critically need supply, this is part of that answer. It's a modest hit. As a former deputy mayor of the city of St. Paul, I keenly understand what it means to property tax shifts. We really think it's a modest shift at most, and we think it's a great investment. So the revenue department study that was conducted a couple of years ago or last year, I think, kind of showed that. So the cost would be modest. We think the impact is significant. A lot of hard work. Thank you to Representative Howard and to many others who have worked on this. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate your support and consideration.
Thank you. Next, we have Ms. Jones. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, I am Shannon Smith-Jones. I'm the executive director of Hope Community. We're located on Portland and Franklin. I am also a PPL board member. Hope Community represents, we have close to 300 units of housing. 75% of that is affordable at 50% area median income and lower, and at least 50% of our residents are at 30% AMI and or lower. For a small nonprofit provider of affordable housing, the tax savings will be incredible for us. Currently, we have all the things. I don't need to repeat what Paul has said, but currently right now we're running non-budgeted amount of money of $40,000 per month just to handle like security and unexpected repairs, right? This is all part of the landscape that is shifting. These tax breaks and that allowing it to go back into operations will make a significant impact on our organization. We do a lot of community building work in the community. We do a lot of food justice work. We have programs for our young people, and the amount of money that we're having to put into the building that is unexpected is really causing a risk to those other programs that are life-giving, right? And these are a majority community of color. There are a lot of young people that come into our space. We serve elders, very cross. You know, if you know the Phillips community, it is a very diverse community, many Native, Somali, African-American. It is the community that is a beautiful place to be, and we want to be able to continue to do this work. Your support for the House File 1808 would make a very real positive and consequential difference in our ability to provide desperately needed housing to marginalized communities and, indeed, all areas of the state which suffer from a shortage of affordable housing. Thank you so much for your consideration.
And thank you for everything that you do. Next, we have Mr. Lightfoot. Welcome to MIDI. State your name for the record and please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Daniel Lightfoot with the League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some comments on House File 1808. The League certainly supports efforts that address the statewide need for affordable housing construction and preservation, and certainly we support the current 4D low-income rental classification program that, as you've heard, does provide a class rate reduction in property taxes to qualifying low-income rental units. And we certainly thank Chair Howard and other members of this committee that have worked with the League on this issue over the past several years to alleviate some of our concerns when it comes to mitigating the property tax shift. Our primary concerns do center around the elimination of the first-tier class rate in this bill for 4D1 rental units, which creates a more substantial impact on the property tax base. We have been involved in previous conversations with the bill author and advocates, which, of course, are very important partners to cities and the provision of housing units in our cities, to find a balance between mitigating the increased tax burden on the existing property tax base, which I should note in some specific taxing jurisdictions is substantial and is higher than $20. And I think it's important to also note that the shifting that this would cause is also against the backdrop of all of the other property tax class rate market value exclusions and class rate reductions that we have in our state and in our cities, which again in some taxing jurisdictions is more severe than others. We also have been working on ensuring that the increased benefit for property owners that this would cause in terms of a property tax reduction also lands on the renters and not just the property owners, though we do appreciate the savings report in Section 6 of the bill. In our conversations with housing providers during previous sessions, it was made clear that the chief concern, as Chair Howard pointed out, is the increase in the first-tier valuation limit indexed to 4A market rate units was reducing the effectiveness of the second-tier 0.25 class rate benefit. Though I do want to note that the 2021 omnibus tax bill did include a provision that froze that first-tier class rate threshold from $174,000 of market valuation back to $100,000 of market valuation for assessment years 22 and 23 for taxes payable in 23-24, which does seem to address the crux of the concern for at least the next two assessment years. And also means that properties with 4D units will, for the first time, benefit from that 2021 change with their taxes payable this May. We appreciate the local approval provision in Section 3, which requires that an initial 4D1 applicant receive local approval. However, I think it's important to point out that this provision doesn't apply to existing property owners that may only have a portion of their units designated as 4D in their building that may want to transition more of their existing non-4D units to 4D units, given the more favorable property tax break with this class rate change. I should also note we also appreciate the transition aid in Section 7 that was referenced by Chair Howard. However, it's important to note that the aid provided in this bill is only for 2 years and is static without any regard to any new 4D units in existing or new buildings that come online. So with that, Mr. Chair, we do believe that expanding this program has to find that balance, and we are committed to working with the author and the advocates on finding a balance to that piece. So thank you, and happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Anyone else that would like to testify for or against? Seeing none, member discussion? Vice Chair Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we are short on time, so I just want to thank Chair Howard for bringing this forward. I know we have a shared goal of ensuring that all Minnesotans have access to, a safe and warm home, when they go home at night. A couple things. I mean, we talk a lot about public goods, and I think when I do become a property owner, right, I think it's okay if I pay a little bit more so that my neighbors, can have access to affordable housing. It's a public good for everyone if we all have homes. But I also do want to, just know I appreciate the survey piece of this bill to ensure that, the property tax cost savings are actually going to be passed down to tenants, because also as a renter, I know that sometimes that doesn't happen, even when we want to incentivize developers to, create more affordable housing units. And so I just want to highlight that piece, because sometimes, we hear from advocates that LIHTC doesn't work the way it should because, those folks are not the folks at the lower end of the income spectrum are not the folks targeted for those units. But I appreciate the proposal, and I'm glad it'll be laid over so we can work out some of the finer details.
Anyone else? Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm thinking of, this is supposed to decrease property taxes on affordable housing to have the, them built and the rents. How much does it pull it down? I mean, what portion of these rents are actually now property taxes with this change?
Representative Howard.
Representative Kwong, I'm wondering if you could restate your question. I'm just not quite grasping it.
Representative Kwong.
We guesstimate, Mr. Chair, what percent of rent is made of property tax. So if you take all the property taxes paid by the owner and you look at the rents collected, is that 17%, 15%, 20%, 10%? I'm not talking about what we guesstimate it to be, but what are the actual realities, so that when we do these programs and we're decreasing the property tax impact on rental properties, does that change the portion of the rent that's property tax? I mean, it'd be nice to actually know reality instead of just guessing.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Liz Lagarde, Representative Kwong, I don't know if I can speak necessarily to the effects of the bill and how that would translate through into rent, but, one thing that I thought would be helpful to bring up, the renter's credit program sort of has a statutory assumption that 17% of rent represents property taxes, and there's been a couple of studies by the Department of Revenue about sort of what share of rents are represented by property taxes, and I think the most recent one is from 2018, and they found that it's about 13.9% statewide, with some geographic variation in terms of rents representing property taxes.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, 13 something versus 17, this is decreasing. I understand that we want rents to be affordable, but be also nice when we do these things. If we are making progress in decreasing at least the property tax that's being passed through into rents, that we should also have that reflected in the other bills that are guesstimating and apparently guesstimating, overguesstimating those percentages. So
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else? Seeing it, closing comments.
Chair Lislegard, members of the committee, just quickly to Representative Quam's point, I would just note that to secure this 4D property tax rate, you are setting your rents at a level, you know, below AMI, and so that piece, to be able to do that, as Mr. Williams and others mentioned, creates pressures, and that's where this property tax piece comes in. This is a strong bill that's required a lot of work, like I mentioned. This is year five. Let's make this the year we get this done. Thanks, Chair Lislegard.
Thank you. Chair renews his motion that House File 1808, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. House File 1808 is included. All right. Thank you guys so much. Grab a donut on the way out, and the meeting is adjourned.